relationship of landlord and tenant between the two, apart from the employment arrangement, this would not destroy it either. This simply doesn't create that relationship. Section 4 of the bill, going back to the bigger hand and gross version, merely takes all notices which are to be served under the Residential Landlord and Tenant Act and says that they can be served personally or by mail. It retains the present special provisions for non-payment of rent notice. There are some mobile home notices which I outline in my written testimony, such as the rent increase notice and the notice which a tenant's association can send to demand a meeting about a rent increase, that are simply not covered by the existing law as to how you serve a notice. This would make it clear that you can mail any notice under the Landlord-Tenant Act. This isn't summons and complaint, but these are the notices that landlords and tenants might serve or send to each other, or you can serve them personally. That's the only change that would result from the amended version of Section 4. Section 5 would make it clear that for those notices which are specified in terms of periods of days, not those which involve hours, this is a 24-hour notice, this is a 72-hour notice, but most notices under the Act are specified, prescribed in terms of days. This provision would merely make it clear that the days are to be calculated by calendar days. There have been some judges who have read days as meaning judicial days, which was never intended. This is merely clarification. Section 7 is probably the most complicated or esoteric version, a portion of the bill, which requires, unfortunately, a little background. There is, under the Landlord-Tenant Act, a right of redemption, which is somewhat parallel to the right of redemption that someone who loses property to a judicial sale has. In the event a landlord and tenant are in dispute as to the amount of rent that's due because the landlord and tenant disagree as to the value of repairs that the tenant had to make, for example, or other problems that arise, and the landlord chooses to use an eviction process to resolve that dispute, present law permits the tenant to pay rent into court if the tenant counterclaims. If the tenant does pay rent into court, then the tenant will essentially take the risk of losing their home out of the controversy. Under present law, if the amount of rent that's paid into court and any amount which is supplemented at least by the time of the judgment is sufficient to cover whatever is due the landlord not only loses on the issue of possession, but can be assessed attorney fees in favor of the tenant. In other words, the landlord can end up having to pay attorney fees to the tenant. This was of great concern to landlords in the situation where the landlord didn't know going into the trial whether the tenant was going to have the option or the protection of this redemption provision. In other words, if the tenant pays rent into court during trial or after trial, the landlord may have gone through the entire trial and incurred additional legal expenses without knowing that unless the tenant was guilty of bad faith, not only would the tenant win on the issue of possession, but the tenant would also recover attorney fees against the landlord. This provision makes it clear that if a tenant is to use this redemption provision and recover attorney fees, whatever amount is ultimately found due, the net amount due to the landlord after the trial, that amount must have been paid into court no later than the commencement of the trial. And in my written testimony, I've outlined the definition of commencement of trial is set by statute for other purposes. In the case of a jury trial, commencement of trial occurs when the jury is impaneled and sworn. In the case of a judge trial, it occurs when the first witness is sworn. Section 8 of the bill, it's hard to see from the Hand and Gross version, but the only change is the last word on the last page, the last word of the last line on page 3, and that is the addition of the word landlord's notice. This has to do with abandoned property notices. Under present law, if the landlord serves a notice on the tenant by mail, the tenant receives the notice that the property is considered abandoned because it appears that the tenant's left it with no intent of returning or claiming an interest in it. The tenant can respond within the period of that landlord's notice and say, I'll come and get it on a date certain. Without the word landlords, there was some possibility of reading the section as allowing the tenant to specify any time in the future and to create a right to come back in 3 months, for example. That was never the intention of the bill, of the statute, and this merely clarifies the existing intent of the statute.
Mr. Marcus, you were here during all of those hearings in 1973.
Both of us were. Well, as a matter of fact, I was not here in 73. I got here in 74. I listened to all the tapes. They're legible. I have read every scrap of legislative history. I have written books on it. And if there was another intent, we've amended 91840 so many times in between that whatever the original intent was would be of only academic and historical interest. Section 11 of the bill is designed to the operative changes on page 6 of the Hammond-Gross version. The highlighted or the bold language between lines 9 and 11. Essentially, the real estate division has rules now which prohibit a property manager, which is not an employee of the landlord, from earning interest on a tenant's deposit without the written consent of the tenant. That doesn't mean the tenants are getting interest on security deposits, although there may be one or two landlords in the world who actually go through the trouble of giving tenants interest. It certainly doesn't protect tenants' rights interest. The result is usually that nobody earns interest on it. In any event, this is designed to exclude from the purview of those regulations deposits which do not exceed $200 per rental unit. Section 12 of the bill is a third attempt to clarify something which some judges never seem to get, and that is that in an unlawful lockout, or all lockouts are unlawful, in a lockout or utility shutoff, a tenant is entitled to statutory damages. The statutory damages under present law are an amount not more than 2 months' periodic rent or twice the actual damages sustained by the tenant, whichever is greater. Some judges have read the not more than 2 months periodic rent as creating a minimum floor so that they are required, regardless of the circumstances, to double the rent in spite of the fact that there are no actual damages. The original version of this in the Uniform Act and in the act as originally passed, and my view of what it's always meant, is the up to 2 months periodic rent. So we have simply taken the words not more than, replaced them with up to, and we hope that this will bring it home for judges who think that you double the rent even if there are no actual damages. You can, it's discretionary, but you need not start with twice the actual rent as a statutory penalty. We've also added the typewritten language, which again clarifies the original intent. The tenant need not terminate the rental agreement, obtain injunctive relief, or recover possession to recover damages under this section. It has been argued in some places on some occasions that because the tenant has a right of termination and a right to recover possession under this statute, that the tenant has to exercise one of those rights before the tenant can be entitled to any statutory penalties for a lockout or utility shutoff. Again, that was never the intent behind the act, and I should say that's also corroborated by the proceedings of the Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, who held numerous hearings in 1972 and put out a ream of transcript. Section 13 is another attempt to clarify something that is a knotty, recurring, unfortunate error on the non-payment of rent notice. The change is at line 36 and 35. If rent is unpaid when due and the tenant fails to pay rent within 7 days, the new language is, including the first day rent is due, the landlord, after 72 hours written notice, etc., can bring an FED. There have been judges who say that a 72-hour notice served on the 8th in the case of rent due on the 1st is premature. Several sessions ago, we took out the word after in an earlier version of the statute to try to make it clear that the 8th day is the correct day, the first correct day on which to serve a notice. The inclusion of the language, including the first day rent is due, is another attempt to make that crystal clear. Section 14 is an amendment which is another attempt to solve a problem that property managers have been having with the real estate division about where they have to keep their rental agreements. There apparently is a practice or policy of the Real Estate Division, and Jim will probably address this in more detail, which requires, specifies the place at which the property manager is to keep the rental agreement. For practical purposes, it may be much more useful to have that rental agreement on premises or off premises. This is simply to put into law that the rental agreement, the copy which the landlord retains, can be either at the resident manager's office or at the address provided to the tenant under the disclosure section. In addition, we've added the bone to the tenants on this is, in case they lost their original copy of the rental agreement, they're entitled as a matter of law to have another copy at an expense not to exceed 25 cents per page or actual copying costs. The final language on page 7 is to make it clear that this does not diminish the obligation of a landlord who has a written rental agreement to provide a copy of that written rental agreement and of any amendments that are in writing to the tenant at the time that the original rental agreement is executed or at the time that the amendments are adopted. Page 8 is the garbage portion of the bill. It would add to the existing habitability section. The changes should be, the place of the change should be clear. The structure of 91770 is that a dwelling unit is considered unhabitable if it substantially lacks any of the things that are listed in this long list of minimum habitability requirements. Subsection G presently requires a landlord to provide an adequate number of garbage receptacles and to provide service for removal unless the parties by written agreement provide otherwise. The new language would provide that in cities with a population exceeding 50,000, the landlord essentially has no option but must provide for the garbage removal service. It specifies that the service must be at least twice monthly, and it must be sufficient in quantity to allow for 30 gallons accumulation a week. I understand that to mean that if you have a 30-gallon container for a tenant, it's got to be picked up every week. If you pick up every other week, you have to have two 30-gallon containers, and we all have garbage, and those of us who don't have garbage compactors know that it takes a good 30 gallons a week for most homes. Make sure that I've got... That's it, with the exception of the property management...
Which we've already covered.
Which has already been covered.
I might clarify for the record, Mr. Chairman, Jim Irvin again, on the garbage section, that it is clear in the intent of this language that the landlord shall be responsible for carrying, providing this service. If, on the other hand, that a tenant does not, need additional garbage service beyond what is required in this law, that it would be the tenant's responsibility. And that if, in fact, the tenant did not, provided additional garbage beyond what was required by the law, had garbage removed by the garbage hauler that was beyond that and received a bill for that amount, that would be between the tenant and the garbage hauler, and that in fact diminution of that service because of non-payment of the overage by the tenant would not be as long as the landlord paid his portion, would not be a defense in an eviction.
I agree with that that interpretation. The landlord's obligation is merely to provide what the statute says the landlord has to provide. If the landlord is also free to provide in the rental agreement that if there are overage charges, that can be collected as rent. And that would make it subject to non-payment of rent eviction remedies in the extreme case. But it is clear that the tenant's right under this is only to receive the amount of garbage collection that the statute provides.
Question, Mr. Marcus. Well, does anybody else have any questions? Are you finished with your presentation?
Yes.
Mr. Marcus, Section 11... Is that the only thing that deals with these trust funds?
Yes, it is.
Sub 11, I think that's the only change.
Yes.
That means that that tenants would have no right to the interest following their money.
if I understand it correctly.
Mr. Chairman, the strange thing about this law is that tenants have no right to the interest anyway. If they did, we wouldn't be giving it up. What this says is that the landlord, under current law, the landlord cannot earn interest, not the landlord, the landlord can earn interest on a tenant's deposit. The current law only applies to property managers who are not the landlord, who are separate from the landlord. A property manager who is employed by a landlord is not covered by the real estate division's law in this regard. It is a independent property manager. That property manager cannot earn interest on that on deposits from the tenant without the tenant's written consent.
That's correct.
Mr. Hawes, would you come forward again?
Sure.
And would you at least clarify what you said and make it concise again so I understand and can fit these together with what Mr. Marcus has to say?
Steve Hawes, for the record again. Yes, the real estate law only applies to real estate licensees, those who are engaged in property management for a fee for others. If you are employed in most cases for the owner of property, you are probably exempt from the real estate licensing law, even if you're a full-time salaried employee. The point I'm trying to make about proposed sub 11 in section 11 of the bill on page 6, and maybe I can just give you the bottom line from what I've heard, is that two things would be operating here in the amendments that have been placed before you. First, they would ask for a special license for real estate property managers. That's fine. Then they come along in sub 11 and suggest something that I think is wholly inappropriate. That is, under sub 11, quote, the provisions of 241, that's basic trust accounting requirements, and the rules adopted thereunder, that's the whole schlemiel, that's everything, do not apply to a real estate licensee acting as a residential property manager who holds security deposits of $200 or less per unit. Now, assuming that someone gets a special real estate property manager's license and they keep all of their security deposits at $200 or less, they have no trust accounting requirement, no accountability requirement like any other licensee. At that point, either the owner or the tenant calls and complains to the real estate division that either they didn't get their deposit back or they didn't get their refund or whatever it was, and the owner calls and complains and says, I didn't get an accounting for my money, I don't know what happened to it, I think somebody stole it, the real estate division would have to answer in that case, I'm sorry, we do not regulate the accountability of property managers for the money that they handle.
That makes it clear.
Mr. Chairman, I think Jim and I first should say that I didn't draft that. That was in their bill when I came here. As I understand, Jim will clarify because it's what he wants. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
There were three things I wanted to point out. The other significant one.
Mr. Hawes.
Yeah, thank you. The other one I wanted to point out was if the question is the draft or the wording of 696-241 sub 5, which says in principal portion, there are two times when, quote, all the parties having an interest in the funds must approve, A, the deposit of those funds into an interest-bearing account, and B, the fact that any interest earned will be paid to the real estate broker or property manager. Okay? If the problem there is the term parties of interest, which gets right down to the nub of it, then perhaps the proper amendment, if there is going to be one, is to 696-241 sub 5 to clearly indicate that tenants are not considered a party of interest. Third point.
Am I getting an affirmative nod from the other two gentlemen sitting at the table?
Yes, to the extent that the deposit doesn't exceed $200 per dwelling unit.
That's correct.
Are there problems?
There would be a party of interest in the deposit in excess of that.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. Mr. Hawes, are there problems with that?
If that is the intent of the committee, that, I believe, is the proper amendment to do what they want to do and only what they want to do. I cannot give you a position from the commissioner since I have not reviewed it with her.
I think then that you and Mr. Marcus and Mr. Irvin should visit Suhanna together.
Thank you. Let me just one
yes,
other.
Yes, go ahead. I keep cutting you off.
That's all right.
My apologies.
No problem. I guess the other point that I'd make is that so far, and we've had a as I mentioned in the letter, receiverships and a number of enforcement actions. So far, the real estate commissioner, the division, is unaware of any hue and cry from licensed property managers that there is any problem in this area.
Thank you, Mr. Hawes. Mr. Irvin, did you have a comment?
I can respond only that I am here on the behalf of the members that I represent who have raised a hue and cry about this particular issue. However, to the point that Steve Hawes spoke in terms of what the intent of what our intent in this proposal was, it is clear that his alternative language resolves our concern.
Thank you. Why don't you just stay up there and we'll ask Mr. Morris to come up too. As the final witness, we're due on the floor at 3:30 and we may be changing rooms. If people say the air conditioning, they tell me it's gotten turned on, but I can't really believe them. We may change rooms if we get excused, but we do want to hurry this along.
Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee, for the record, Brad Morris with the Oregon Association of Realtors, and I'll keep my remarks very brief. I have to echo the comments of the Deputy Commissioner, Steve Hawes. I have not received a great hue and cry on the problem of the $200 deposit, nor have I heard specific comments from our membership, which represents over 6,000 realtors, on the issue of a separate license. The position that I carry into this room today is basically one of no position that's been given to me. I would like the opportunity to take whatever final draft it is that we're looking at back to our membership to discuss, and would hope to have that opportunity. I think it's a bit unfortunate to have four and perhaps even more documents before us at the meeting and not be made aware of some of these substantive changes that are being proposed, particularly in the interest of in the area of property management license. That's unfortunate.
I would like to comment that that's a valid comment, and hopefully you will direct it partially to me and partially to the two gentlemen to your right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any further witnesses on this bill? Hearing none, we'll close the hearing on 2643 and open the work session on 3188. Is the jury trial for juveniles bill. This is the juvenile, the bill is rather straightforward. It provides for a jury trial in juvenile court cases. Counsel, is that a fair statement?
That basically is, yes. I mean, in juvenile court proceedings, it allows for a jury trial.
Now, when we're talking about this, we're talking about what kinds of juvenile proceedings?
Delinquency, status offenses, dependency, neglect jurisdiction. It includes termination of parental rights as well.
Is I think Ms. Sherbo has an interest. Is she here? Nearby? Thank you. The interest on this bill, I think, was directed, or the interest or the objection was primarily, if I recall, the public hearing directed towards the possible money impact or fiscal impact, and you have in your packets a report from Legislative Council, and or not Legislative Council, Legislative Fiscal.
Actually, I think it's from the Court Administrators.
From Kingsley.
Yeah.
Plick. On the projected fiscal impact and additionally the Juvenile Rights Project, I think it's fair to say that there's some controversy over the cost of providing a jury trial in these matters. The chair would move that we add a subsequent referral to Ways and Means onto this bill so that the disputes that are involved here are things that can be addressed in that committee. Is there a discussion of that? Is there objection to that motion? Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Bauman, do you move this bill?
Yes, I do.
Representative Bauman moves.
I'll move the bill with a DUPAC recommendation to full committee.
It'll be sent to Ways and Means.
Right. Yes, it will be. Yes.
The motion is, and I'll place the motion by Representative Bauman to be move the bill 3188 to DUPAC as amended, that is, with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Is there discussion? Hearing none, Linda?
Bauman?
Aye.
Bellamy?
Aye.
Dix?
Aye.
Ellen?
Aye. Motion is adopted.
Wonderful.
We will open the work session on 3345.
Yeah.
Representative Bauman and counsel.
Do we have copies of an amendment?
Yes, there should be copies. There should actually be two. There should be a hand engrossed, which on line 24 of page 1 reflects a change, if you'll recall, at the public hearing.
Okay, you've got that.
And then there's the dash ones also.
Okay. I think if I can just speak for this bill, I suppose first for the amendment, we had a series of detention bills, and out of all of the detention bills, there was a portion of one that seemed compatible with 3345, and we've amended it, and it's in the dash one amendment, and it pertains to the capacity of it's on page 5, line 6 through 10, to use the state training school or another secure treatment facility where a child's been placed on formal probation for an act which would be a crime if committed by an adult or is on parole from one of those facilities. And my understanding is that up till now there hasn't been the capacity to use detention for these kids. The remainder of 3345, I don't believe there was any opposing testimony.
I don't think there was.
And so the object is to create really backup support for community correction services for juveniles.
I'll just make a comment that the juvenile bills that have been submitted to this committee have been, I have referred those to Representative Bauman, and those of you that are involved directly are aware of this, and that Representative Bauman has been the one that's been integrally involved And taking the bills that were publicly heard and making recommendations to this committee, and this bill is the first recommendation that we have.
In addition, thanks, that's accurate, Mr. Chair. In addition, there is that change that Council noted on page 1, line 24 of the bill.
The purpose of which is?
What was the purpose?
Well, it was kind of just a, not really an offhand remark. I believe it was Don Welsh. Is that from the Judges Juvenile Justice Coalition? Is that the name? Apparently, was it the Juvenile Rights? Angela, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong. I thought he had indicated that preventive measures was a more acceptable term than sanctions in that particular part of the bill.
Right.
And that editorial mark means sanctions will be deleted?
Right.
Okay.
So,
Representative Bauman.
Well, I don't know if there's no more discussion. Mr. Chair, I would make a motion that House Bill 33, well,
you want to
first I'll move the amendments.
Representative Bauman moves the -1 amendments dated April 27th.